Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today John Scalzi. His new novel, Red Shirts, just came out, and he joins us by telephone from somewhere in the wilds of southwest Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
John, the book just came out this week. You had the big rollout. Did you go to Book Expo with it?
I did. We actually had the debut at Book Expo on the 5th, and so I went there to do a panel and to do a signing, and then I started the next day on the 7th my book tour, which went through Dayton last night, actually, and we'll go through Cincinnati, and then I leave Ohio for Houston, Chicago, Milwaukee, and other parts unknown.
And are you having fun yet?
I am having fun. The thing about book tours is I really do believe that people are going out of their way to come and see you. So you really do have to give them entertainment value, so to speak. And so what I like to say is that from the moment that I get up there at the lectern till I've signed the last book, I'm in performing monkey mode. And that is, you know, I try to be very engaged. I try to make sure that people are having a good time. And so it's a lot of fun to do that and to be engaged with people. But as soon as it's done, you kind of go, and it's just because it's very tiring to be on for hours at a time. But, you know, one can't complain. This is the worst that one can say about book touring is that it's tiring. But it's a sort of high-class problem to have, so I'm not going to complain too much.
I read your previous book, Fuzzy Nation, and I know that was a tribute to an earlier book, kind of a legendary cult classic. And this new one, Red Shirts, underneath the title it says, they were expendable until they started comparing notes. And this is a bit of a tribute, too, isn't it?
It is a little bit. It's to the tribute a little bit to the Star Trek universe, but also the basic concept of what a red shirt is in science fiction community and fandom. And for anyone who doesn't know, the idea behind a red shirt is Kirk and Spock and Bones go down to a planet on an away team, and they have a security attachment with them who wears a red shirt, and he's like Ensign Jones or Ensign Smith. And somebody in the away team has to die for dramatic purposes, and it's probably not going to be Kirk or Spock or Bones because they are, you know, they have a contract that runs through the end of the year. So poor Ensign Jones is going to get, you know, eaten by a monster or shot by a phaser or have rocks fall on him. And you just have to think, that poor man, he's lived his whole life to get to this point where he'll be attacked by a monster that just wants to suck all his blood out of him. And so the whole idea of what is it like for these people knowing that if they go on away team, there's a good chance they won't come back. That's really got to color your expectations of what you're doing.
And we always know, no matter how many times we watch that program in syndication, that poor schlub in the red shirt is going to buy it.
He's totally going to buy it. And you sort of want to yell at the screen, don't go with them. Don't, you have to know. It's not good. But they always just go, and they never seem to add it up on the Enterprise. And it's not just the Enterprise. I mean, there's other shows where, you know, they don't always wear a red shirt, of course, because that's a Star Trek thing. But there's always, you know, the spear carrier to the right or, you know, just some poor schmo who is there and just, you know, we stars are going to come, and you come along with us, Ted. And Ted goes, great, I'm going to go with you guys. Oh, no. And then he's dead.
So how did your work as a creative consultant on a program called Stargate Universe influence you in the writing of this?
Well, one of the things that was really nice is that Stargate Universe hired me because they wanted to avoid things like the stereotypical red shirt, right? They didn't want to do just the things that people expected because they were sort of expedient in traditions in the science fiction universe. But even then, I remember reading a script, and one of the scripts was had a crewman walk down a hall. But instead of saying, you know, crewman Jones walks down a hall, they said actually in the script itself, red shirt walks down the hall. And I'm just like, dude, that dude's not making it to the end of that hall. You can just tell. But they were actually very good at avoiding that sort of thing. One of the things about Stargate Universe was the idea was they were trapped on this spaceship that was literally billions of light years away, so they couldn't get reinforcements. They couldn't get any sort of they couldn't restock, and so everything they had was everything that they brought with them, and that was it. And so early on, I told them, because some of the early scripts had crewmen dying left and right because that's what crewmen do, and I pointed out, you know, when you kill them, you can't replace them. Pretty soon, your entire starship is just going to be run by the top five stars, and that's not going to work. So for Stargate Universe, instead of the red shirts getting killed a lot, basically what happened is they ended up being maimed a whole lot. And so the maimed red shirts of Stargate Universe, that's me. That's my influence.
John Scalzi joins us. His new novel is Red Shirts. Give our listeners a little nibble here. Tell us what the basic gist is of the book. I read it, but I'm leery of giving away too much.
Sure, sure. And there's a lot of spoilers, so there's a lot to you know, get through. But basically the idea is that in a, you know, future universe where humans have colonized the stars and have a government that's called the Universal Union, there's a spaceship called the Intrepid. And on the Intrepid, our hero, whose name is Andrew Dahl, arrives to start his tour of duty. And one of the things that he and some of his friends begin to notice is that the junior officers and other crew members spend a lot of time avoiding, you know, some of the senior officers, for example, the captain or the science officer or the chief engineer or the astrogator. And they're wondering why this is and why people seem to be so obsessed with away missions. And then they figure out that what happens is, statistically speaking, if you go on this one of these trips with one of those senior officers, chances are pretty good that you won't make it back. And so the entire culture of the spaceship is trying to avoid these officers just because otherwise you're going to die. And so they begin to wonder, how could this possibly be? And so they begin to explore it, and that's sort of the whole gist of the book, as they explore why this statistical anomaly exists, and the further they explore, the weirder and weirder and weirder it gets. So that's the basic elevator pitch of it.
And one guy has figured it out, but we're not going to talk about him.
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, I'm guessing since your book Fuzzy Nation came out a year ago, has that just come out in paperback?
It did come out in paperback in April, yes.
Okay. And that was a tribute to a book called Little Fuzzy.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very different book. I really loved this book because these little fuzzies are so cute.
Indeed they are. That's part of it. They're cute in the original book, which was called Little Fuzzy, which was published in 1961. But for this, I also based them a little bit on my cats. I have three cats, and then I have a cat that I used to own who is unfortunately now deceased. And so I took their basic personalities, and I use them as a template for the fuzzies themselves. So if they seem cat-like, that would be why.
John, I have to remark about the fact that you wrote this book as a tribute to this cult classic by H. Beam Piper, and he's kind of a mysterious character, I gather.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also kind of a cult figure. Didn't someone write a song called Red Shirts, and aren't people creating covers for your book? And I mean, what's going on here, John?
Well, with the Red Shirts song, that was actually something specifically for that was done by an artist named Jonathan Colton for the book. He's a friend of mine. He's actually famous among geeks for writing some songs about zombies or people who program. And he also wrote a song called Still Alive, which is in the final credits of the video game Portal, which was seems, for people who don't play video games, might not seem like anything, but it's basically pretty much almost exactly the same as having the ballad at the end of a credits running in a movie. So, uh-huh. I mean, the video game sold millions, so it was quite a boost for him. And so he's a friend of mine, and we had talked for a long time about, you know, him possibly doing a song for me. And so I sent him Red Shirts, and so he went ahead and made the song. And it's a fantastic song, I have to say. I was really pleased about it. But this is also, in a larger sense, the stuff where people create stuff based on what you write. This is part of what science fiction and fantasy is like. It's part of that community where people, when they like something that you've done, they don't just buy it, but they also begin to say, you know, I want to see more adventures in this area. And if you can't do it or you don't have enough time or something like that, what they'll do is they'll just take it upon themselves to create what is called fan fiction or fan art or any of those sorts of things. And it's not meant to be, I'm taking your stuff and I'm going to go make money with it. That's not what they're doing at all. What it really is saying, we love this so much that we can't wait for you to do the next thing. And so while you are writing up your next thing, we're going to go ahead and play with your characters for a little while, and we hope that's okay. And my feeling is that if you get to the point where people love what you're doing so much that they're creating fan art or fan fiction, then you've reached a really good place because you know that they will continue to take that journey with you. And as a writer and someone who needs to pay a mortgage, that's a fantastic thing.
And John, you have a very regular audience that reads you every day, don't you?
Yes, I have a website that is called Whatever, and it gets up to about 50,000 visitors a day, and I talk about basically whatever I want. That's why it's called Whatever. It doesn't have any particular theme. Just some days I, for example, will feel about talking about my cats. Some days I'll talk about politics. Sometimes I'll talk about the craft of writing. Some days I'll just take pictures of a sunset. It's really whatever gets my attention at the time. But it's been really nice because in between writing books, I come out with a book about once a year or so. In between writing those books, it's a good way for me to stay in contact with people who like my writing and who are interested in what I'm doing.
And your background, you go back to the early days of America Online. I understand that you were one of the early bloggers for AOL and that you've really learned to incorporate all these various types of media. I checked out your blog the other day and you were riding on the Amtrak or something and you were posting your tweets about being in this space where you couldn't make noise.
Right.
You couldn't use your cell phone.
Right.
And all these technologies are merging, and you seem to have a really good grip on all this.
Well, I think part of that is, just a curiosity about what people are doing and how people are talking online. There is I think that people get too worried about, is one form of communication going to supplant another form of communication, or what does it all mean? Basically, at its heart, people want to talk to each other. People want to tell stories to each other. People want to stay in contact with each other. And technology, over time, gives them new and different ways of doing it. And, I'm personally curious about it all. I mean, there's no reason that because I do a blog, I shouldn't also do Twitter, or that because I have a Facebook page that I shouldn't do Google+, or because I write print books that I'm sort of wary of electronic books. It's all pretty much the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize that in each of these new media, you have an opportunity to make contact with people, get them to learn about you a little bit, and have fun with it. I mean, the thing that you were talking about the tweets from the train, what I had done was I was in the quiet car of the Acela, which is the Amtrak that goes between New York and Washington, D.C., and in the quiet car, you're not supposed to make noise. And so I was going, gracious, we are all of a sudden, it's like the entire quiet car has broken into a cast recording of Merrily We Roll Along, of various sort of ridiculous things that are going on that really wouldn't go on. And part of it was just because you're in a quiet car, you want to sort of make fun of it. But part of it is also because it's sort of entertaining for, I have 30,000 Twitter followers. It's a great way to do a little bit of communication with them in a medium that works for me when I'm not allowed to, use any other sort of technology.
I think the thing that I enjoy the most about your blog and your tweets and your books, and in this new book in particular, is it is fun that you really have a sense of humor. And I know that you've taken this to extremes. I'm aware of your book where, what is it, the Android's Dream,
where
the first chapter is very distinctive.
That's a very good euphemism for it, sir. Yes, you are correct. It's the first The first chapter of it is someone trying to flatulate someone else to death. And the reason to do that was take the most ridiculous idea that you can think of, and can you actually make it work, not just as a one-line joke, but for an entire chapter. And so the thing about humor that I don't think a lot of people realize is how difficult it can be. I mean, let's say that I want to write a scene where I make you cry, and the aim for me is to make you cry. And if you don't cry, if it only works 60%, that scene still works. Instead of crying, you get a lump in your throat. It's pretty much achieved the goal. But if you write a humorous scene, not only is it very binary, it either works or it doesn't. But if it doesn't work for you, then you're not going to be neutral about it. You're actually going to be annoyed, you know, because someone is going to tell you, and when someone tells you a joke and the joke doesn't work and it's not a funny joke, you're actually kind of annoyed. It's like, I was promised a joke. You have failed, and now I'm upset. And so it's the recognition that what you're doing is actually technically, as a writer, pretty difficult stuff to do consistently over and over again. And so that's part of the challenge. I mean, with that challenge of that first chapter of Android's Dream, or with all of Red Shirts, is to make it humorous, make it enjoyable, make it actually flat out funny, but at the same time, give them something else there that, you know, reaches in to their chests and squeezes their heart a little bit.
I think my favorite character in the book is the star character who they abduct and take back through time. I love this character.
He's the sort of person that you are, who is outside of their little loop of reality, where they've said, here's the problem, here's how we solve this problem, we need this person to help us solve this problem. And they just sort of take him along for the ride. And so he's experiencing it like any sort of normal person would in that circumstance. It's like, what the heck are you guys doing, and why are you doing this to me? But he is ironically a very sympathetic character, because he's trying to figure out what's going on just like everybody else. He's like the guy who comes in halfway through the movie and is like, I don't understand why does that guy have that gun at that person's head? What's going on? And somebody has to catch him up. So,
My guest is John Scalzi. His new novel is Red Shirts. I think it was about 5 years ago, I went to Book Expo in Los Angeles, and I was really excited because one of my idols was supposed to be there to sign books, and I was waiting, standing in the autographing area, and then we were told at the last minute he's not coming, he didn't feel like it. And I understand that when you were 12 years old, you met Ray Bradbury.
Yes, I did. He was doing a talk at the Glendora Public Library, which is in Southern California, which is where I grew up. And he was always a big fan of libraries. He apparently spoke at libraries was always happy to schedule to go and talk to people and to, you know, celebrate the joy of reading and stuff. And I had read by that point, you know, The Martian Chronicles, Something Wicked This Way Comes, in Dandelion Wine, all of these books. And he was a remarkable writer. I read quite a lot of science fiction and fantasy, and what he had that a lot of writers didn't is he actually had a very moving flow to his words. They weren't just words being used to tell a story, but the way that the words were used themselves were part of the effect. And I remember even being 12 years old and, you know, thinking, you know, maybe one day I want to be a writer, just looking at that and going, goodness gracious, he really knows what he's doing. He's like a wizard. And I remember wanting to talk to him at 12 years old about writing craft, but then I got in front of him and I just, you know, my tongue fell out of my head because what can you do? It's Ray Bradbury. And he was, like I said, very kind to me. He said, you know, encouraged me to do the writing, and then he went up and gave his speech. And so it was a pretty important moment for me. We were all just shocked and very saddened this week when he passed away. It really is the passing of an era. But the great thing about what he does is that his words will endure. People will be reading The Martian Chronicles, I suspect, for more than 100, 200 years. It's going to be one of those things that when they look at the literature of the 20th century, that's going to be on the very short pile of books that make it forward.
Well, it's bound to be reissued on Mars eventually.
One would hope, yes, indeed.
John Scalzi joins us. John, is it true that you're distantly related to John Wilkes Booth?
Yes, it is absolutely true. Not directly related. He's a great, 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 so on and so forth, uncle. And it's really interesting when people, when I mentioned it to people, either people go, oh, that's interesting, or I've had some people actually physically recoil, you know, because even from, you know, 170 years down the line, it's still something that people aren't particularly comfortable with. It's like, you're related to, you carry tainted blood. And, I try to make a joke about it. It's like, yes, I'm related to John Wilkes Booth, and that's why I'm not allowed to touch pennies or $5 bills. But I've found, actually, that there are a few other people who are related to John Wilkes Booth as well. There was a screenwriter named Helen Childress, who did this book called, or did this movie called Reality Bites back in the 1990s, and she and I were both related to John Wilkes Booth, and so we formed a secret club called the Six Semper Tyrannis Club, and we were just, you know, kind of had fun with it. But to be blunt about it, John Wilkes Booth was a horrible man. He shot probably the greatest American ever, you know, Abraham Lincoln, and it's sort of, in one sort of sense, enough time has passed, so it's an interesting thing to talk about. But on the other hand, I would have rather that he not had done that and just continued to be famous for being known as an actor and not the man who had shot Lincoln.
So you're probably more closely related to his brother, who was a much better actor, Edwin Booth.
Oh, Edwin, absolutely. Okay. In the early days of the Internet, when everybody used different names in their own, my pseudonym was Edwin Booth because he was just a fantastic actor. He was the iconic Hamlet of his age, which was pretty impressive for an American actor to do. And one of the really interesting things about the Internet for me was one day I was tooling around the Internet, and I came across an audio recording of John Wilkes Booth, Edwin Booth, doing Shakespeare. And he recorded it when he was like 80 or, you know, so it wasn't in top voice or anything like that. But at the same time, here was someone I was distantly related to, you know, 120 years down the timeline, and I can hear his voice. And it was the Internet, of all things, that brought that to me. And I thought that was just fascinating. You know, it's like, hello, uncle, how are you?
John Scalzi joins us. His new book is Red Shirts. And another thing, besides your sense of humor that I like about you, is that you're willing to get involved in things far outside of the realm of books and science fiction. And I heard about your experience at the Creation Museum, and that really tickled me.
Well, I think that's part of just what I do for my blog anyway. Like I said, the idea behind the blog is to write about what I'm interested in as opposed to, you know, using it as a marketing vehicle. That would get boring extraordinarily quickly. I would much rather talk about the things I want to talk about. And so, yeah, I did this thing where I'm a person who very firmly believes in the theory of evolution. So when the Creation Museum came around, some of my readers challenged me to go to it. I was like, no, I don't think that's something that I'm going to be doing. But they kept persisting on this, and I said, all right, fine, I will tell you what. And I made a challenge to my readers. I said, I'm going to do a fundraiser. And if you meet my goal, and my goal was fairly low, it was $250. So if you meet my goal, I will go. Pay me $250. I will donate all of it to the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, and I will go and I will give you a full report. But you have 1 week to raise this money. In fact, the money was raised in an hour, and by the end of the week, I had raised $5,100 for this thing. So I was obliged to go then. But it was two things. One, it was the evidence of, you know, the readership definitely wanting to see me do this and willing to back it up. And I think also they sort of perversely enjoyed the idea of me having to go to this place. So I did. I went and I did the full tour. I took a bunch of pictures, and I posted a long essay about visiting the Creation Museum. And so that was, you know, definitely an interesting experience for me. And I, you know, and I owe it, you know, positively or negatively to my readers going, and, you know, we've done things like that before. I've used my readership to raise funds, for example, for my local library, when I finished Red Shirts, I auctioned off a pre-production galley of it, and we ended up raising $10,000 for my local library, which was kind of fun because they didn't know I was doing it, and so it took them a little bit by surprise.
Wow. I'm sitting here holding a galley. This thing's worth 10 grand. I'm just kidding.
It was, but now the book is out. But, you know, but that was the great thing about it, is because I've been doing the blog since 1998. There's 14 years of history there. I have a track record of, you know, saying, if I do something where I say to my fans, I'm doing this and we will, you know, and all the money will go to X, that they trust me that I will actually send the money to X instead of putting it into my pocket or doing anything else along that line. So it means that I get a lot of interesting adventures. And it also means that, you know, on the site, I will talk, like I said, I'll talk about politics, or I'll talk about religion, or I will talk about same-sex marriage, which I think should be legal in every state in the union. And there will be people who agree with me, but there will also be, and this is important, a lot of people who will disagree with me on the subject. And as long as, you know, the conversation is kept civil and people are respectful of each other, I'm perfectly happy to let people criticize my point of view, because you can't really just throw your words out there to the wind and assume that people are not going to respond. So there's a lot of back and forth, and that's one of the things that I actually value about the site, is that people are having good and intelligent conversation about some of the great topics of our time.
And that is whatever.com?
It is whatever.scalzi.com.
Okay.
But if you go to Google and just type in the word whatever, it will take you to the site.
Sweet.
Yes.
Well, John, it's really been a treat to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm glad to do it.
My guest has been John Scalzi. His new novel is Red Shirts. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening. And if you missed the Book Nook program in any particular week, you can always go to our website at wyso.org. where we have an archive of over 80 podcasts. You can listen to old Book Nook programs in their entirety from the past year or so. And while you're there, why don't you make a pledge? The Book Nook comes to you through the generosity of listeners just like you at wyso.org. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.